Today's Teisho will be on case 87 in the Hikigan-roku in the Pienlu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 87 is entitled Umon's Medicine and Sickness Cure Each Other. Engo's Introduction. The clear-eyed man knows no restriction. At one time, he stands on the top of the mountain with the weeds thick around him. At another, he is in the bustle of the marketplace, enjoying perfect ease of mind. When he displays the wrath of Nada, he is three-faced and six-armed. When he shows the mercy of the sun-faced and the moon-faced, he gives forth the all-embracing light of blessing. In every particle, he reveals all the bodies of the Buddha. Mixing with people, he trudges through the mire. When he performs a transcendent action, even Buddhas cannot follow him, and they are driven back thousands of miles. Is there anyone among you who can go with him and act with him? See the following. Main subject, Umon said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All the earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself? Secho's verse, all the earth is medicine, ancient and modern. Men make a great mistake. Shut the gate. Do not build the cart. The universe is a highway, vast and wide. Mistaken, all mistaken, though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will still be pierced for a rope. So I want to thank everybody who came to sit this morning and was sitting so deeply. Many people read books on Zen and read books on Buddhism in general, but fewer people practice the Great Way, and even fewer people practice the way we were practicing this morning, really just wholehearted, go for broke sitting, right? Just wholehearted, go for broke sitting. That's really marvelous. And everybody was sitting so still in deep samadhi. And that's absolutely thrilling. I believe that this is the best way to live, with all due respect. We got up early this morning, we came to sit, we've been working through many obstacles, and we've been breathing the fresh air of freedom, right? Freedom that comes from working through our obstacles. It's a hard work, it's hard. This is like the hard work is sitting on the cushion. And sometimes your legs hurt, sometimes your back hurts, and you get off the cushion and there's like an imprint of your perspiration has left on the mat. I know this from long experience, right? I've had to launder many mats. You're not just sweating, you're not just sweating out your physical impurities. You're not just purifying your body, you're purifying body, mind, and heart. And it's hard work, but every once in a while, and increasingly, the more you practice, you get this, it's like the obstacles, as they're cleared away, you can breathe freely. And also, people spend so much time holding themselves in. Yesterday I talked about the fact that, basically, we cling to our chains, we cling to our obstacles. And actually, as Zen training goes on, it's, people, the more insecure and fearful and uncertain people feel, the more they desperately cling to their chains, you know. So you know, definitely in a sesshin there's a period where people are beginning to quote unquote lose control, right? Lose control. And at that moment they become they cling even more, right? But at some point, you know, they let go. And it's just the most wonderful thing in the world. And how is this done? It's done on the cushion, you know, just as we were sitting here this morning. And it takes a lot of sitting. It takes a life of sitting, you know, a life of sitting to accomplish this goal of waking up. You know, even after you have your Daikensho experience, there's still a life of sitting ahead of you. You continue to purify body, mind, and heart. So I cannot thank you enough for the wonderful sitting that went on this morning. And, you know, this is kind of an amazing achievement, right? We're in different geographical locations. Some people are in China, some people are in Taiwan. But we're all practicing together, and that collective energy is so amazing, right? So liberating. If you sit by yourself, you know, that's great. But when you sit with other people, it's like many times over that energy is multiplied. And this is just, that sitting today was proof of that, you know, wonderful practice. So, you know, if some of you are new here, and if some of you are relatively new to Zen, I don't have to tell you that it is challenging, right? When I started sitting Zen, when I started sitting Zen, I mentioned the other day that I had read some books on Zen meditation. And I started sitting by myself, I started practicing with Takabayashi Genki Roshi. And Genki Roshi was quite an amazing sitter. He had been, when I met him, he had already been practicing in a temple milieu in Japan for 30 years. And he started his Zen career as a little boy when he was 12 years old. He was an orphan who was adopted by one of the leading Zen teachers in Japan at the time, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, Genpo Roshi. And Genpo Roshi adopted this little boy. You know, Yamamoto Roshi was trying to be kind, but he had no idea how to be a Zen teacher. He was a great Zen teacher. He had no idea how to be a father, right, to a little boy. And he was actually like a terrible parent. He wasn't an abusive parent, but he just hadn't a clue, right? So, you know, Genki Roshi grew up in this milieu of the temple. And he was like doing sesshins when he was 12 years old. And we asked him once, we said, what was that like, you know, doing sesshin when you were 12? And we thought he would say, oh, it was amazing, right? You know, I made such rapid progress. But he said, in the middle of sesshin, he said, I would pray for an earthquake. And that earthquake would happen and it would pull the temple down on my head and kill me, right? So wasn't what we expected. Very, very challenging, right? But when I met him, he was no longer praying for earthquakes. You know, he would sit down on the cushion and go into deep samadhi like that. He was very accomplished and he put great emphasis on basically sitting on a cushion, and he encouraged us to sit full lotus. Now, some people are anatomically incapable of sitting full lotus. I had a good friend at the Seattle Zen Center, Steve was his name, and he was totally devoted to meditation practice, and Genki Roshi was pressuring him to sit in a full lotus, and he kept trying, and his body wouldn't do it, you know, and eventually he, for that and other reasons, he quit practicing Zen. And I'm sorry Genki Roshi pressured him so much, because he really loved Zen, and he struggled with his posture. His body was not very flexible, and he eventually was able to sit Seiza style, that is, with his legs tucked under him and a cushion under his bottom. And actually, he made great progress. I changed my mind. You know, I loved my teacher, Genki Roshi, but I myself sit full lotus. But I changed my mind about that, because I saw people who were making great progress when they weren't sitting full lotus. They were sitting Seiza or in half lotus or in other postures. So I definitely think sitting on a mat is hugely helpful. I think everybody's body is a little different. And I think the important thing is to drop body and mind when you sit. In other words, be able to enter into deep samadhi. So, you know, it's actually rather difficult, if not impossible, to enter the deepest forms of samadhi when you are sitting in a chair. You will not see any statues of the Buddha sitting in a chair. The Buddha's usually sitting on a cushion, and he's usually in full lotus, as a matter of fact. When I began practicing Zen, I actually thought this might be a superstition, you know? So when I sat on the mat, I would sit Burmese style, which is a perfectly good way to sit. You have a leg here and another leg in front, and they're both on the ground. And Genki Roshi began to encourage me to sit half lotus and then full lotus. And I sort of humored him, but I thought Burmese style was fine, you know, and it was actually pretty good. And I think I made a lot of progress, and there's nothing wrong with it. But one day I took my right leg and I put it over my thigh and my left thigh, and all of a sudden it was like some added pressure to, like there was added, I don't know how to put it, but like added internal pressure. And I noticed a difference in my sitting, you know. It was a little bit more internal pressure. And then later I actually tried like full lotus, and it was like a lot more internal pressure building up. This sounds crazy, but I realized, you know, actually sitting on a mat allows you to enter into samadhi in a way that sitting on a chair doesn't. And, you know, if you try, say, sitting half lotus, and by the way, don't try it in the middle of a sesshin, whatever you do, okay? Don't change your sitting posture right now. That's like learning a new stroke as you're struggling for your life, as trying to swim across a raging river. So please don't do that. But what I noticed was that when I put my right foot over my left thigh, I felt like there was a pressure, kind of pressure building up, and I felt my mind just sort of like emptying out. And the reason I got into sitting full lotus is that when I did that, I felt it even more, like even more internal pressure, and my mind was sort of like emptying out. So, you know, there's definitely a somatic or body dimension to meditation practice. And, you know, we Western people are so head-oriented, right? we tend to think all the action takes place in our heads. But, you know, the human body is a unity, right? Body-mind unity. In fact, you know, Western people think everything happens in your head. People in ancient India and China understood that body-mind is like an energy system, like a total energy system. So, you know, when you sit down on a cushion, especially if you're a modern Western person, it's not comfortable, right? I mean, first of all, you want a back support, you know? You want something to hold you up, and there's nothing to hold you up. And also, you know, when you sit with your knees on the mat, whether you're sitting seiza or Burmese or in one of the lotus postures, you know, after about half an hour, it's becoming a little uncomfortable. And after an hour, you know, it might be quite uncomfortable. And, you know, when I started out, I thought this is like a superstition. That was 40 years ago. But, you know, then I quickly noticed that when I put my body in the proper position, I entered into like an altered state of consciousness, like more and more deeply. And we in Zen call that altered state of consciousness samadhi. And that sort of like feeling of like pressure, like internal pressure, or it's like jumping off a diving board and going into the deep end of a pool. You know, when you feel that pressure building up, it pushes you into an altered state of consciousness. And, you know, we don't pay much attention to the body aspect of sitting, but it's really important. You know, sitting, if you move, let me just say, if you're in agony, you should move. You should adjust your legs and find a posture that works a little better. And there's nothing to be gained from pulling your legs up over your thighs and having shrieking pain. So whatever you do, don't do it. Whatever you do, do it gradually, experiment, realize that bodies are different. But there's definitely a somatic element to practice. And it's crucially important. And it's complicated, right? Because when we're somewhat uncomfortable, right? It's just somewhat uncomfortable. Or when we feel a kind of pressure, we descend into or ascend into, however you want to put it, into deep samadhi. And this is, I think, really interesting that this happens. So, you know, I met another Zen teacher once, a Chinese Zen teacher, who said the body is a machine for waking up, basically. It's perfectly designed for waking up. And I agree with him. So when we sit down on the cushion and we put our legs on the floor, or we put our legs under us, or we put our feet over our thighs and so on, and we breathe from the dantian, from the hara, we're activating the body-mind system. And we are creating a problem, actually. We're creating a problem. Because when you sit, you know, I have a chair in my office that I sit in when I'm working. And I got it from IKEA, believe it or not. I have tried several chairs, and I got a chair from IKEA. And when I sit in that chair, it's great. I recommend it. It's like $150, maybe less, from IKEA. When I sit in that chair, I'm totally oblivious to my body. I'm just a brain with some fingers, right, typing. And I can sit there for a long time and not notice my body at all, right? You know, when you sit down on a cushion, after about 20 minutes, man, do you notice your body, right? You notice. And especially if you've been doing sesshin here for this is day four for you, you know, you got up this morning or last night, you were, man, your body was talking to you, right? And it's a kind of crude, it's a little bit crude maybe, but see, that's how we become aware of our bodies. See, that's how we become aware of our bodies. It's like the resistance. It's a resistance that creates the awareness, see. And so, you know, when you sit in a chair, which is like a machine that's designed to make your body awareness disappear, you know, there's no chance of waking up, believe it or not. That nobody ever had an enlightenment experience in an easy chair, in like a Lazy Boy, right? That's never, you know, you never hear about that. Man in Lazy Boy has enlightenment experience, right? It never happens. You know, because it makes your body disappear, it actually cuts you off from the world, right? So when you sit down on the cushion and you're feeling like, oh, you know, this happens to me too. I've been doing this for 40 years and I will get up in the morning and I will sit down on the cushion and I'll realize, oh crap. You know, my left buttock has to be a little lower than my right buttock for me to be comfortable. And if it's not, somehow I realize, oh crap, my right buttock is too high, you know, and then the rest of the sit might be a bit of a struggle, you know. So you know, suddenly I'm pushing, and I'm aware of my body. And I become, you know, my body comes to life for me as a machine for waking up. See, it's like suddenly this thing that was dormant comes alive. And now it's a bunch of problems. It's like a car that has all these things maybe that have to be, all these valves that have to be tightened and so on. So then I have to shift a little bit this way and a little bit that way. But all this time I'm descending into deep samadhi. And when you're in deep samadhi, sometimes it's like your knee hurts, but you just push yourself back into that depth, into that blankness, see? And your mind is getting into a deeper, deeper, deeper state. And it's like you're entering an altered state of consciousness. Without this situation, it would be impossible to wake up. So that even though nobody likes having pain in their legs, even though nobody likes having pain in their back, you know, it's actually like, it's not the pain, it's the resistance, right? It's the resistance. it puts pressure on you and forces you to change out of your customary mental habits. And it works like magic. You know, yesterday afternoon, we've been doing a little different afternoon schedule because we're not at Murray Grove. We're not cooking in the kitchen and mopping floors. So we have less work to do to keep the Zendo clean and everything. So usually we have we start at 2:30 and then we have an hour sit and then a break until 4:30 when we have afternoon sutras. And I changed the afternoon schedule, so now we have a sit at 2 and we go to 2:35, and then there's a 15-minute walking meditation, and then there's another 35 minutes. And that's harder than just an hour of sitting, actually. That's like an hour and a half of concentrated attention. And last night, people came into the Dokusan room, and they said, it was like one person after another had a deep engagement with the koan. And it was like three people in a row said, I realized this in the afternoon after that long sit, right? So, you know, the pressure that builds up, the obstacle of sitting, the obstacle that we experience when we sit on, or obstacles that we experience when we sit on the cushion, bring the body to life for us in a new way. You know, we begin to experience the body in a different way. And people eventually begin to experience the body in a really different way. So if you're in deep samadhi, you know, sometimes you might feel like your whole body has disappeared, or your body is emptying out. You might feel like you're a stick of incense and you're just disappearing from the head to the ground as you sit. You know, sometimes people feel like all that's left of their bodies when they're in deep samadhi is their face and their hands, and everything else is gone except maybe a little bit of discomfort in their knee. Some people even feel like they're floating off the ground, or feel like they're made of stone. You know, people will say, I felt like I was a boulder in the ground, you know. Now, these are all different ways of experience, different non-ordinary ways of experiencing the body. And they're, I would say they're all real. They're all real. We don't normally experience our bodies that way because we live in samsara. We live in a state that's very distanced from everything around us. We are constantly separating ourselves from the world around us. And, you know, when we begin to engage with the world, when we get into contact with the world, you know, it starts to create obstacles for us, challenges for us, right? And when we experience, when we walk back from those challenges, it pushes us back into our samsaric state, into isolation. But, you know, if we are not daunted by the challenges, if we know how to drop into deep samadhi, into mushin, emptiness, you know, we work through those obstacles and we achieve connection with the world around us. Yeah. So this is true not only for the body, but for the way we experience our own minds, right? You know, people normally live in a very, very tiny mental world, right? Very tiny. And we live in like this, if you imagine consciousness as this continuum or a broad bandwidth, we live in a narrow little bandwidth, right? All the time. Create this very narrow life for ourselves, you know, where you get up and you think, okay, what do I want for breakfast? Then you turn on the radio while you listen to your breakfast. Uh-oh, got to get to work. And now you might or might not drive to work, but in the old days, you'd jump in your car and you'd get on 287, and every day you'd say, ah! Why did I get on this so late? You know, I should get here half an hour early. Then you get to work, and you know, it's like I have to do this, I have to avoid doing this, don't talk to him, talk to him, home, dinner, TV, bed, you know, and next day same thing. So, you know, this keeps us in kind of like blissful ignorance of ourselves and the world. So, you know, when we do Zen meditation and we sit down on the cushion and we have pain in our legs, we breathe through the pain and we enter deep samadhi, and eventually we enter shunyata, mushin, mushin. And, you know, when we can get to that place, it's often like the eye of a tornado, right? You know, no matter what's going on, we're in this centered, still, focused place. Early Buddhists called this shamatha, shamatha. So when we're in mushin, we're now in a comfortable place, but now it's time to like encounter our mind. We've been working with our body, now we're going to work with the mind. So, you know, if you're working with the koan, as we do in our tradition, you know, I'll give you the koan, and of course the fantasy is that I'll give you the koan, you'll be in deep mushin, you'll internalize the koan, and you'll immediately have the answer. But what happens instead is all this, all these obstacles arise, or so-called obstacles, right? So you said, you know, you're in deep mushin and you're working on the koan, and the koan says, the koan is Joshua's cypress tree in the garden. And you think, oh, cypress tree, you know, how wonderful. You know, but I love cypress trees. They're evergreen, beautiful. I'll contemplate the cypress tree. So, you know, you're working on cypress tree, cypress tree, cypress tree. And all of a sudden, you know, all these feelings come up. You remember having to move when you were 10 years old and leave all your friends behind. And then, you know, maybe you remember you were in high school and your father died, you know, and suddenly you and your mother were by yourself. And so on and so on. And you think, well, where's the ecstasy? Where's the enlightenment? You know, I don't want to revisit this, but it's all coming up, right? And actually, this is a crucial part of waking up. Now you're getting in touch with your mind, you know, which we studiously stay away from. And for good reason. It's difficult to unpack all that. But, you know, you start sitting on the cushion and you want to tell me about the cypress tree, but instead all this stuff is coming up about, you know, things that were difficult. And you might even experience not only just some psychological discomfort, but some physical discomfort as you're working through this. You know, but actually, if you just keep going back into mushin, eventually, you know, what will happen is that these powerful feelings or memories begin to have a different character. You know, nobody can make it right that your father died when you were 16 years old. That's irreparable. Nobody can tell, oh, he's in heaven or something like that. That doesn't make it right. But you know, your experience of these events changes in a way. They stop being obstacles for you. And actually, the obstacle becomes a door. Every barrier becomes a door. See? And that's true for the body, for meditating with the body. You know, the pain in your leg actually becomes a door into deeper consciousness, you could say. And, you know, when we encounter these obstacles on the cushion in our minds, right, they also become doors, you know. So, and without obstacles, you could say without obstacles, no doors, you know. So you know, this is actually, you might say, well, when is he going to talk about the koan? Ulong said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All the earth is your medicine. Where do you find yourself? How do you find yourself? See? And we don't find ourselves by looking in the mirror. We don't find ourselves by taking a personality test, right? We Zen people find ourselves by encountering our bodies and encountering our minds in deep samadhi, deep samadhi. See, deep mushin. And little by little, we work through all of these obstacles, become like stepping stones to waking up. See, all of these obstacles become like stepping stones to waking up. And it's just as nobody wants to be in physical discomfort, nobody wants to be in psychological distress. Nobody wants to, and Zen is not just about being in psychological distress, but there are moments of real psychological distress, but that's when we do the hard work of liberating ourselves. All of these things are karma. They block us off, you know. When I was a kid, I grew up, I spent some of my life in Baltimore, and I lived in the Lock Raven, if you know Baltimore. I lived in Lock Raven, near Lock Raven Boulevard, and I used to go to school every day, and you know, there was this, I talked about him, there was this guy, Bobby Westbrook, who used to beat me up, you know, and I would think, how can I get to school without getting beaten up, you know? And if it wasn't Bobby, it was somebody else. You know, I developed habits of being very guarded and fearful, you know, as a little kid. And I think Zen has really helped me to confront those. And they were invisible to me, right? They were invisible to me. We can't see what we've hidden from ourselves in order to protect ourselves. But when we sit down on the cushion and we learn how to enter deep samadhi, we can begin to unpack all of that. And it's just like, you know, sometimes you're sitting on the cushion and your legs hurt so damn much and you're watching the breath and suddenly it's like the pain sort of goes away. It's like you get to the center of the storm and it's totally placid. And it's like, oh, I can handle this. And you get off the cushion and sometimes your legs are sore, but sometimes you feel like a million bucks. And it's the same thing when you confront your inner obstacles. You know, it might be a tough slog for a while working through some of those obstacles, but then, you know, suddenly their character changes. You know, I'm never going to be glad Bobby Westbrook beat me up. I'm never going to say, oh, I'm so glad he beat me up many times. But I definitely understand Bobby Westbrook now so much better. I see him as a suffering person. And in some ways, he actually did make my liberation possible, my experiences of liberation possible. So I'm very grateful for Bobby Westbrook. At any rate, many things can be transformed if we are willing to engage with them. And there's no other way to wake up except to engage with them. All of these, every obstacle, just say to yourself, when you're having a tough time, every obstacle becomes a door. Everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. Engo's introduction. The clear-eyed man knows no restriction. Or you could say he no longer sets boundaries for himself or herself. At one time, he stands on the top of the mountain with the weeds thicker around him. At another time, he is in the bustle of the marketplace, enjoying perfect ease of mind. This is somebody who's worked through a lot of obstacles. When he displays the wrath of Nada, he is three-faced and six-armed. In other words, sometimes he pretends to be angry. And when he shows the mercy of the sun-faced and moon-faced, he gives forth the all-embracing light of blessing. He occupies every identity emptily and with the goal of helping others. In every particle, he reveals all the bodies of the Buddha. Mixing with people, he trudges through the mire. When he performs a transcendent action, even Buddhas cannot follow him, and they are driven back thousands of miles. Is there anyone among you who can go with him and act with him? See the following. How do we get to be like that? Cool. Woman said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All of your obstacles are your medicine. Okay. Where do you find yourself? How do you find your true self? Please go into deep machine and encounter your obstacles as they arise. Have courage and please trust the process. Okay. Setra's verse, all the earth is medicine, ancient and modern. Men make a great mistake. Shut the gate, but do not build the cart. The universe is the highway, vast and wide. Mistaken, all is mistaken. It's okay to be mistaken. See, we all have obstacles. We all make mistakes. Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, like because they're snobs, see. Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will be pierced for a rope, like a rope in a bull's nose. In other words, we all have to do the hard work. You know, it would be nice if we could sit, you know, when people talk about healing, they think of going to a meditate, a retreat for a few days where they just have nice thoughts and have deep breath and bliss, like bliss, you know. But if people could sit down on the cushion and enter bliss unfailingly every time they sat, Zen would be a dangerous drug that should be banned, okay? It wouldn't be liberating at all. It would be a drug. So you could kill somebody and then sit down on the cushion and feel much better about things. You know, that would be bad, right? You know, liberation requires us. Real, true liberation isn't the search for bliss. It's the search for awakening. And there are definitely moments of bliss. And awakening is definitely bliss. But, you know, we have to trudge through the mire sometimes. And on the other side of that is something really wonderful. So please, you know, please trust the process.